Just to recap, we started a couple of weeks ago with the Sam Selvan text, and I suggested that we might want to look at the various meanings generated by the text under a set of headings. So last week we looked at Raymond Williams's work on a particular way of understanding forms of belonging, which was labor. In some ways, what Sam Selvan's novel is trying to do is to show how people find work in a new place, how that affects their relationships with each other, how that affects their relationship with the space they're in. So in some ways, what Williams was nudging us towards is understanding a mode of living via work or labor. So that category was our previous week's problematic. This week, we're going to switch focus a little bit via Frederick Jameson, and we're going to look at consumption. So last week was production. This week, we're going to look at consumption, consuming, and how that changes again, or not changes, affects the relationship between people, between people and spaces, but also, crucially, between a literary or cultural work and the form it employs and the genre it belongs to. So the overall kind of hook for today will be consumption. Now, before we start delving this topic, let's have a show of hands, like real honest show of hands, about every time you have used the word postmodern to get some street cred, right? So there's been a kind of party, you've sat down, and you've said, oh, that text, or that piece of music, you know, it's really postmodern, or pomo, right? At which point your friends, have kicked you out, right? Saying you're such a twit. But show of hands about the use of the word postmodern. Let's have a quick look. Well, none of you have done it. I can't believe it. None of you have dropped the word postmodern in a party. You have. Very good. Did you get kicked out?
No.
No, you got lots of guys. Okay, all right. So that's a tip in the future to show off your literary credentials, right? That's the way to go about it. That's so postmodern, you say. Now, I say the word postmodern today because obviously that's one of the key words in the Jameson piece. And he offers that particular term both as a periodizing concept, i.e. a historical concept. So postmodernism or postmodern gestures towards a particular era of history for Jameson, but also, crucially, a particular style. So really what he's trying to do in this passage is to draw our attention towards the correspondence between a historical era and the cultural style that produces. So that's the kind of key thing to keep in our heads now. A particular phase within modernity called the postmodern and the set of styles it generates. Now, the crucial thing for Jameson, for you to remember about Jameson is, for him, style is not just literary style. That particular style he's calling postmodern can be seen most obviously for him in architecture, in music, in clothes, in fashion, and obviously in literature and films as well. So he has a very wide range, eclectic range of culture references, and he's suggesting they can be united under this rubric, stylistic rubric of postmodernism. So in some ways, what he's trying to get at is this correspondence between particular historical periods and particular kinds of style they generate. Now, before we go into the passage proper, let's see what he means via this clip. Okay, Blade Runner, obviously, how many of you have seen it? The director's cut or the director's cut? Okay, few hands there. See the director's cut, because that changes a lot of things. Is Deckard a Lexus 6 or not, for example? Okay, now, the thing about that particular clip, obviously, is the focus on the cityscape, right? What did you notice about that very, quite brief, I could have chosen the opening shot as well, quite brief glimpse of Los Angeles 2019? What struck you about that cityscape? Besides the darkness and the music, obviously, but what? Did you notice anything about anything particular that stands out for you? Do you want me to play it again? No? High-rise buildings. Of course, not just high-rise, but, you know, super high-rise buildings there. Anything particular about the buildings that struck you? Sorry? The advertisements, very good point. And that's one of those of you who've seen Blade Runner will see the kind of pervasive presence of those ads, the smiling faces that are selling you the vision of what they're calling the off-world colonies, right? So one of the things about LA 2019 there are a couple of things that come out from the clip. One is that pervasive selling of dreams of the off-world colonies whose wealth funds that city. Those enormous high-rise buildings that you see Harrison Ford weave his way through in the film, they are built on the labor of these mutant robots, Lexus 6 people, who work in the off-world colonies and generate the wealth on which that city is built. That's the first thing. So you don't really, when you walk around LA 2019 in the film, you see a lot of buying and selling going on. You don't really see where that particular money or particular kind of wealth comes from, right? So in contrast to what Williams is focusing on last work on work, what we're looking at here today is buying and selling, purchasing, consuming, right? So that's the first thing, that pervasiveness of the ad world. The second thing are the buildings themselves. All of them are enormous, obviously, as you said, skyscrapers, but they also are built in a kind of hodgepodge style that quotes earlier architectural styles. Some of them, for example, the Tyrell Corporation building, the one they're going towards, brings to mind the ancient ziggurats of Mesopotamia. That's how it's built. It's like a flattened out, slightly flattened out pyramid. And once they go inside, of course, they find that the chief of the Tyrell Corporation can change the mood and the lighting and the space, whereby it becomes an ancient Mesopotamian, sometimes an ancient Egyptian landscape within the room. So what you see are modern buildings, high-rises, etc., that have incorporated within their fabric, incorporated within their body, architectural styles of the past. Ancient past, or a version of the ancient past. Now, that particular kind of incorporation of earlier architectural styles or cultural styles effortlessly within the body of a modern text, if you want to call a building that, is what Jameson is pointing towards as being one of the key things about the postmodern style. So LA 2019, that vision in sketched by Ridley Scott in 1982, is the archetypal postmodern city. It's already here, although in the film, of course, it's set in the future in 2019, architecturally, stylistically, and materially, because it's driven towards buying and selling, that pervasive presence of advertisement there. Materially and architecturally, it's what Jameson would call the postmodern. Now, coming back to Selvin and starting now in earnest to kind of try and grapple with what Jameson's point here is. So remember those key points. Postmodernism is a historical period. postmodernism generates a kind of style which is tagged to the idea of perpetual consumption and perpetual citation of or recycling of past styles. So keep those two key points in your heads. And now we'll go a little bit deeper into Jameson and try and see how we read Selvin. Because what I'm going to try and suggest here, Selvin's is a particularly interesting text here because it's trembling on that cusp between modernism and postmodernism. It incorporates certain postmodernist elements, but it's also defiantly opposed to others. So when we are talking about a historical period and a historical style, think of Selvin's novel as a transition point between the two, between what we might call a high modernist style and a renovation of that high modernist style into or edging towards a postmodernist impulse, but never quite giving into it. It's kind of, it's a midpoint between these two eras and two stylistic matrices. Okay, so let's take the first key point that Jameson makes in the piece that you've read, which is about postmodernism as being a particular kind of reaction, historical and artistic, against modernism as such. So, your first quote on your handout. Most of the postmodernisms, notice he uses postmodernisms here, a variety of stylistic responses, emerge as specific reactions against the established forms of high modernism, against this or that dominant high modernism which conquered the university, the museum, the art gallery network, and the foundations. Those formerly subversive and embattled styles, think of that opening paragraph that we'll come to that in a little bit, that Selvin consciously quotes Dickens and Eliot, amongst others, in his description of the London. So one of the things that Jameson says postmodernism is as a style, it's a rebellion. It's a reaction against formerly radical style, literary and cultural styles, Eliot being the kind of normative figure here. Abstract expressionism, great modernist poetry of Pound, Eliot, or Wallace Stevens, are now felt to be, that were felt to be scandalous or shocking by our grandparents are, for the generation which arrived at the gates in the 1960s, felt to be the establishment and the enemy, dead, stifling, canonical, and reified monuments. One has to destroy to do anything new. The second feature, so that's the first feature, postmodernism as a stylistic rebellion against artistic movements and literature that was felt to be radical once in the 1920s in the case of Eliot, or in the case of Dickens a lot further back in the 1840s, 1850s, and the 1860s. All those styles had a radical edge to them once. No longer for the generation of 1960s, they're trying to overthrow or react against that particular literary inheritance. The second feature of this list of postmodernisms is the effacement in it of some key boundaries or separations, most notably in the erosion of the older distinction between high culture and so-called mass or popular culture. This will be very evident in the Selvin text. We were talking about in the first week about how the text effortlessly moves between calypso, street slang, popular music, and the novel form. So that's the kind of erasure that Jameson is talking about. No longer can we separate a kind of high, exclusive, elite style from what we might call the popular idiom within the body of postmodernism. So, two things to keep in mind. One, postmodernism as a style arrives in the generation of 1960s. So it's quite historically specific. In the generation of 1960s, who are reacting to against what were perceived to be radical artistic phenomenon of the preceding decades. That's the first thing. The second thing is about postmodernist style is this erasure between the popular and the high artistic style. So, for example, in Los Angeles 2019, Blade Runner, you'll see there is virtually no difference between the world of advertisement and the world of scientific specialist labor. There's a scene where this guy is making eyeballs. It's quite a nice scene. Eyeballs in this kind of boiling water and freezing laboratory. But the world of those specialist scientific high knowledge, high cultural niches, and the world of advertisement and commercialization can't be kept apart. So that's going on within the film. And that's a particular postmodernist sensibility. So what you have here is a particular historical moment that generates a rebellion against a formerly radical literary and cultural a set of literary and cultural impulses, and a historical moment that sees the definitive erasure between the world of commerce and the world of art. There is no possibility of separating the two. If you think of that definition, and if you think of Selvin's novel, at first glance, it might appear to be one of the key early, in fact, one of the novels that seem to anticipate postmodernism. Look at Carol Phillips's description of the novel that we touched on 2 weeks ago. If I were to point to a writer who captures the tone, the texture of London when the austere 50s were about to give way to the swinging 60s, note that conjunction of that particular period again, like Jameson's location of the emergence of postmodernism as a style in the early 1960s, Carol Phillips too locates the novel as a transition, locating the transition point between what he calls the austere 50s and the swinging 60s. It would have to be the work of Sam Selvin, which would figure preeminently. He did not only know the Caribbean, but the pages of London's A to Z, and was able to capture these with a haunting lyricism. Again, that gesture between knowing London's A to Z. This is really London at a popular, basic level, elevated into a work of art. There is no distinction. Selvin's art is not possible without the engagement with the popular and the material. So London A to Z, which is something all of us use, or a lot of us use when we are lost in London, becomes a part of the novelistic form. So at first glance, going by what Jameson says about postmodernism, Selvin's novels seem to feature those key elements of postmodernist style. And it emerges at a particular historical moment that seems apt for this kind of style. So in one of the arguments you might want to make is that this is a kind of early postmodernist text, right? What I'm going to try, and it's possible to defend that argument, what I'm going to try and suggest to you for the rest of the 25, half minutes, half an hour, is it might be oversimplification to do so. The novel carries postmodernist elements, but they exist in conflict and in battle with some high modernist elements as well. Hence, it's a transitory form. It's a novel that captures both worlds or several worlds together within its fabric. But we'll come to that later. So the first key point about Jameson's talking about postmodernism is emergence of a particular style at a particular period, and the key features of that style being a kind of eraser of the boundaries between the popular and the elite, both in terms of art forms, but also in terms of what is actually going on, because the world of commerce, the world of advertisement, has invaded every corner of public life. I take advertisement as a kind of shorthand for the world of commerce, for the world of consumption. Isn't there this iconic television series going on now, Mad Men? Mad Men, how many of you have seen Mad Men? Quite a few. One of the reasons why, Mad Men fans, anyone here? Yeah? There's one very strong, committed fan out there. Okay. The reason of the iconic charge of Mad Men is, of course, not just the kind of production value of the series, but that it captures that bit about 1950s, as Carol Phillips says, is about to turn into the swinging 60s, where consumption and not work in the kind of traditionally understood sense of the word work is going to become the dominant idiom in society. Okay. So that's Mad Men-like. Actually, not very like Selvin, captures that particular moment of transition. Okay, now remember what we are talking about, the building, how those buildings quote architectural styles, or not quote, they incorporate architectural styles of the past, those buildings in LA 2019, the ziggurat, the Egyptian pyramid, the ancient Indian temples, all of those, the Chinese pagodas, all of them find their echoes within the architectural fabric of those huge, gigantic corporate buildings. This brings us to the second key point about Jameson, Jameson's argument about postmodernism, and that point hinges on this difference between what he calls pastiche, right, and what he calls parody. So for him, for Jameson, pastiche is the hallmark of postmodern style, and this means we have to find out what pastiche is. Okay, so here is Jameson. They, that is to say postmodern architecture, literature, etc., no longer quote such texts as Joyce might have done. They don't quote previous or earlier texts, as, for example, James Joyce does in Ulysses, or a Mahler. This is a very Jamesonian move. He'll go between kind of classical music, popular music, architecture, literature, etc. Slightly to scare you, right? To say, you know, how can this man know so much? They incorporate them to the point where the line between high art and commercial forms seem increasingly difficult to draw. Pastiche is, like parody, the imitation of a peculiar and unique style, right? It's an imitation of a past style. That's the key point. The wearing of a stylistic mask, a speech in dead language. But, and this is the key difference, but it is a neutral piece of such mimicry. Without parody's ulterior motive, without the satirical impulse, without laughter, we'll come back to laughter and Selvin in a little bit, without that still latent feeling that there exists somewhere normal, something normal compared to which what is being imitated is rather comic. Pastiche is blank parody, parody that has lost its sense of humor. In a world in which stylistic innovation is no longer possible, all that is left to imitate dead styles, to speak through the masks and with voices of the styles in an imaginary museum. That's pastiche. Now, pastiche is that LA building that you just saw. Why? Because there's no separation within it between a past architectural style, let us say the ziggurat or the pyramid, and the contemporary expression of architecture. They're seemingly effortlessly blended into one. There's no difference between the two. Parody would be a architecture or a text or a music that retains a sense of difference between what it is quoting, an earlier form or style, and itself. In pastiche, that gap doesn't exist anymore. Okay? So what you have in postmodernism is this endless circulation of pastiche. A building can be simultaneously be futuristic, can be located in the present, and can incorporate within it several styles of the past without any sense of distance between that particular past and the present of the building. Similarly, for a text, it can incorporate any number of previous, or cite any number of previous authors without distinguishing or without maintaining a gap between those authors, as Joyce, for example, does when he quotes Shakespeare over and over again, amongst other authorities, within his text. But the difference between Joyce and a postmodernist text is that Shakespeare, whoever those past authors might be, are now seamlessly a part of the fabric of the text. There's no sense of distance between them. So hence, pastiche is a parody that has lost its sense of humor. It can't laugh at the past anymore. It can't laugh at a kind of comic moment whereby which separates itself and the past styles it's quoting, right? So pastiche has no sense of irony at all, and that for Jameson is the second hallmark of postmodernist style. It constantly cites other styles without distinguishing between them. Moreover, it also fails or deliberately doesn't distinguish between those past styles and its own unique or present moment, both in terms of what it's trying to say and how it's trying to do. Now, that, remember those Los Angelino buildings? That's what pastiche is, right? A building that is simultaneously and effortlessly a futuristic corporate building and an ancient Egyptian pyramid at the same time, with no sense of difference or disjunction between the two. In literature, that's pretty much what's going on, or in music, that's pretty much what's going on in postmodernism. Jameson cites Talking Heads, for example. Talking Heads, that's a blast from the past, isn't it? Right? How many of you know Talking Heads? Wow. Lots of Brian Eno fans here. Is that right? Okay, very good. So Talking Head fans will realize what this means, or people who have, how many of you DJ? Any DJs over here? Okay. You'll see that's a particular postmodern form of mixing where past other songs, for example, any of you've been unfortunate to spend any amount of time in front of MTV, will see all these song titles that are about this big, and the artist titles that are about that big, right? Because they feature X, who in turn features Y, and they feature Z, right? That's what the artists are. It's a collaboration, but they're all citing each other without any temporal break within the music notation, right? So what you have here is a remixed, a recut music that is not citing previous styles, but is incorporating those phrases within its new track. Right? That's pretty much what dancehall music of the 1990s is. That's pretty much what house music of the 2000s is, or what dubstep of 2010s is now, or whatever the latest house music style is. Chill wave, isn't it? Chill wave, and what's the other one? Witch house, right? So they're citing all these past influences. How many of you have been to a witch house or a chill wave party? Okay, so it's coming. Keep it on your radars, right? So that's what they're doing. They're citing musical influences without separating them. That's archetypically postmodern, right? So that's Jameson's second point and the kind of second key point you should keep in mind. That distinction between what is postmodern pastiche and what is modern, what in modernism was parody. Because parody has a sense of ironic humor. You're, in a way, generating a comic distance between your own writing or music or whatever it is, architecture, and your influence that you're consciously bracketing. You know, Shakespeare, isn't he great? But I'm laughing at him as I'm writing, right? That kind of parodic moment is lost in postmodernism. Look at the opening passage of Selvin again, and now decide whether this is postmodern or high modern, i.e., whether this is pastiche or parody. Because we talked about this briefly before. One grim winter evening, when it had a kind of unrealness about London, Eliot, with a fog sleeping restlessly over the city, Dickens, and the light showing in the blur as if not London at all, but some strange place on another planet, Moses Alouette hop on a number 46 bus at the corner of Chepstow Road, etc. So what you have here are citations, are quotations that seemingly are blended in to the passage, but look at that comic parodic effect, right? Moses, that's integral to the tone of the passage, right? Moses Alouette hop on number 46 bus, etc., to go to Waterloo. Both the Caribbean, street Caribbean diction that turns standard English into this mixture between orality and written literary forms, and that whole bathetic effect of Moses Alouette jumping on number 46 bus to go to Waterloo Station, they seem to undercut or hold the past citations of Eliot and Dickens at a comic sort of gap with a comic distance. Okay, so a part of what Selvin's saying here, okay, London is a city of Dickens and Eliot. That's the tradition I'm writing within. But I can distance myself from Dickens and Eliot via the kind of rhetoric that I'm employing. And it's a comic register, Right? He's not quite laughing at Dickens and Eliot, but via laughter, he's distinguishing his own idiom from this past, that inheritance of past writing about London. And that's a typical Selvan gesture. So what you have here, now what you have to carefully decide is whether this is parodic, i.e. He incorporates previous styles and previous subjects and forms from Dickens and Eliot in this case, in order not so much to laugh at them, but to generate a kind of comic laughter that marks this particular text as being unique. It has Caribbean voices in it that regenerates, in some sense, London for us, right? And it also regenerates the sense of English literature for us. For the first time, or this is one of the early instances, where London doesn't only arrive at us through a different set of eyes of narratorial perspective, but also a different kind of language altogether, right? The language has ironic comic overtones. It draws on demotic Caribbean oral and street literary or street linguistic devices, and it refashions London for us by showing the distance between itself, its own sensibility, and the past kind of literary and representative traditions via Dickens and Eliot, etc., that have settled into our understanding of London. So what we see here is London afresh, but also a literary style afresh. Suddenly, we are no longer imitating or mimicking or crumbling under the literary burden of talking about London via Dickens or via Eliot. Now we are refashioning a language via this comic distance between our past inheritance and our present utterance. So what you have to be very careful is, although it's seemingly, like as Jameson says, seamlessly incorporates past citations, past styles within its fabric. There's nothing here in the passage that says this is Dickens or says this is Eliot in parentheses or within quote marks. It's pretty much integrated within the passage itself. It nevertheless maintains a comic distance between those citations and itself. And by doing so, it reinvents London for us and reinvents a new language for us. Okay? So is Selvan a postmodernist writer? I'd be hesitant before to jump on that kind of umbrella conclusion just because he's citing, like those buildings are citing, or recirculating previous stylistic forms. He's also doing something else. He's drawing on a different kind of language and literary and cultural inheritance to refashion our view of London. And that is not necessarily can be subsumed under the sign of postmodernity as Jameson understands it. So this is why I say the novel trembles between these two moments, stylistic and historical. It incorporates different kinds of stylistic devices. Sometimes they're in contradiction with each other. And that contradiction generates the novel's energy. Okay, so Selvan is that occupies that transitory moment between styles and between periods: the austere 50s, the swinging 60s. 50s are usually in your imagination is austere precisely because they're associated with backbreaking labor and not much to buy or splash out. Right, 60s swing, of course, because you can buy new stuff. Right. Including new drugs and new lifestyles, etc. That's why 60s swing. So the transition between production and consumption marks those decades in our commonsensical understanding. Obviously, the real picture is much more complicated than that. Okay, so that's our second key point about Jameson and how we use Selvan to derive a complicated understanding of that transitory moment between modernism and postmodernism as styles and as periods. How are we doing for time? Okay, 20-odd minutes. I think we can cover the rest. Now, one of the things that Jameson talks, this is the third key point about postmodernism, is what we might call its perpetual presentism, right? Postmodernism is presentist. Now, what does Jameson mean by that? Here's where we come to his passage on schizophrenia and literature, right? This is Jameson. Now, you remember from your reading at one point when, and this is the moment, when he talks about postmodern culture, he draws an analogy between postmodern culture and schizophrenia. Not so much because all of us are irrevocably separated from ourselves, not necessarily, because he makes it very clear. He doesn't mean that postmodern stylists or the great writers and filmmakers and musicians he's talking about are schizoid. But he's talking about what we might call in an older language the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, right? That is schizoid. Why? Because of its presentism. Now, this is the passage. It is because language has a past and a future, because the sentences move in time, that we can have what seems to us a concrete and lived experience of time. Because we're linguistic animals, because our primary relationship with each other is constructed via communication and language, our sense of time passing too is linked to language, the structure of the language itself. It gives us a sense of time passing via the velocity of sentences, tenses, grammar, etc. But the schizophrenic does not know language articulation in that way. He or she does not have our experience of temporal continuity either, but is condemned to live a perpetual present with which the various moments of his or her past have little connection and for which there is no conceivable future on the horizon, i.e., the schizophrenic lives in this medical condition, lives in a sense of perpetual presence. There is no sense of the past or the future. Note that as temper, and then you'll remember in the Jameson excerpt, he cites this case study of a schizophrenic woman who's talking about her life, and this is what Jameson says. Note that the temporal continuities break down, the experience of the present becomes powerfully, overwhelmingly vivid and material. The world comes before the schizophrenic with heightened intensity, bearing a mysterious and oppressive charge of affect, glowing with hallucinatory energy. But what might, so this seems to be quite a nice thing, right? You have this intensely hallucinatory, almost a kind of drug high about the present. The experience is so bodily and materially intense. But what might for us seem a desirable experience is here felt as a loss, as unreality. As meaning is lost, the materiality of words become obsessive. As its sense is the case when children repeat a word over and over again until its sense is lost and it becomes an incomprehensible incantation. And those are the key kind of Jamesonian descriptions about postmodernist style. Just as schizophrenics, because of their medical condition, lose the idea of past and future and live in a constant present, similarly, postmodernist language and literature become trapped because they have lost a direct referential relationship with the material world. They become trapped in this solipsistic universe where repetition of words or repetition of textual meanings become all-encompassing, right? They're delinked, they're divorced from any reference towards the material world. That's the third postmodernist strain or cultural style that Jameson detects. Now, this is a difficult point to grasp, because what he's talking about here is really the development of a textual universe. Previously, not quite commonsensically, we think of texts reflecting reality that's outside text, right? The texts are about something. The texts are reflecting a material world via its form, its story, etc. That's how we normally understand text to be. Jameson is suggesting, because of certain historical reasons that we'll come to in our final point, the postmodern text or postmodern style do not so much talk about the world outside it as it talks about the other texts that make it up. So hence all those citations, effortless citations about the past influences. So in some ways you can say the postmodern writing or postmodern style is essentially writing or composition about other styles, other literary styles. Their primary referent is not the world any longer. Right? Although they might be writing about the world, obviously not all postmodern, in fact, no postmodernist novel or poetry or film will only be, it'll have a story, it'll talk about, you know, whatever, Los Angeles 2019 or whatever it is, it'll have a story, it'll refer, it'll gesture towards external reality, but because that reality is so mediated via other styles, in effect, it becomes a dialogue between various kinds of styles. The text becomes doubly or trebly displaced. There's no longer a conceivable link between the text and the world it's trying to capture. And one of the signal moments or signal features of this style, of this perpetual sort of, this trapped sense of being, the sense of being trapped within a variety or a host of other texts is a perpetual sense of being in the present, i.e. a loss of our sense of historical past. So when in that building, LA 2019, the Tyrell Corporation building, when you see it, or people who inhabit it, or people who build it, consciously cite an Egyptian past but have no idea what that past is. Right? That past, that idea of ancient Egypt, has been reduced to an architectural idiom. They have no idea about the reality of Egyptian life or Mesopotamian life from which that style historically arrives at us. So there's no sense of that history at all. All we are left with is a style. Okay? And that is what postmodernism does. It, for Jameson, it's a constant citation of dehistoricized previous styles. Right? You in your lifestyle, in the buildings you're in the music you're listening to, in the books you're reading, it's heavily stylized, but there is no sense of the historical context of that style. So, again, with Selvin, you have to treat this particular proposition carefully, because when you reach that odd moment in the novel, all of you've read the novel by now, so when the narrative suddenly switches into that perpetual present in the description of the park life in summer, right? So I've given you an extract from it. Oh, what a time it is when the summer come to the city. Note the tense there. The is, the present, that constantly rears its head throughout all the sentences. There's no temporal break in those sentences, right? How the old geezers like the sun, they would sit on the benches and smile everywhere you turn, the English people smiling. Isn't it lovely day, as if the sun burn away all the tightness and strain that was in their faces for the winter, and on a nice day, every man-jack and his brother going to the park, etc., goes on for a kind of 10-odd pages or 8-odd pages. It's a kind of hallucinatory moment when summer suddenly arrives in the city and you have a sense of perpetual summer in the language that you have. You have a sense of never-ending summer. You have a sense of a perpetual presentism, that this is the present you're locked in, right? And the language reflects that sense of perpetual summer after a harsh winter that's arrived. So again, you could say, going via Jameson's proposition of postmodernism being a presentist style with no sense of past or future, that this is an archetypically postmodern moment. There is no sense of past summers or past histories of the city. The character or the narratorial point of view here gives a sense of living in the moment. All the narratorial point of view is interested in is giving you a sense of an erotically charged summer. That's what it's talking about. And there's no kind of temporal discontinuity between the sentences. It's a one long sentence or a couple of long sentences that stretch over 8 or 9 pages. Now, you could say that you could argue that's an archetypically postmodernist moment. But note the tension within which that particular passage exists within the context of the novel as such. The point at which it breaks off and the point at which it rejoins the narrative. This is a narrative where the characters are overloaded with a sense of history. Their sense of melancholy, their sense of belatedness is driven by the memories of the island they've left behind, and the new home and the future home they've made in London. In no way can you reduce the characters or the narrative consciousness of the novel as being presentist as a whole. Because one of the prime charges of the novel, as we've seen, of course, is the memory of displacement, of migration, of immigration, and of a future that they're working their asses off, right, to establish. So it's a novel as a whole that has history coded into every kind of gene of its sentence. But within which you have this moment where suddenly that temporal expanse is shuttled into the background. You have this explosion of this heightened notion of being alive, of being present at a particular moment, i.e. summer, at a particular location in London. So again, what you see are juxtaposed sensibilities and juxtaposed styles. A novel which is loaded with historical sensibility, breaking off into the sense of the perpetual present. A kind of high modernist consciousness about emigration, migration, displacement, belonging, juxtaposed with this new sensibility of capturing a moment at its most intense. So a juxtaposition of modernism and postmodernism emerging in a novel that is historically situated between the two eras of modernism shading into a productive modernism, shading into a postmodernism, which is about consumption. So final 4 minutes, just to reiterate that link between a particular style and a historical period. This is what you will have, one of you said, commented on the perpetual presence of the advertisement in LA. And this is pretty much what, for Jameson, connects the postmodernist style with the postmodernist historical moment. The way in which, this is your final Jameson quote, the way in which our entire contemporary social system has little by little begun its capacity, began to lose its capacity to retain its own past, has begun to live in a perpetual present and in a perpetual change that obliterates tradition of the kind which all earlier social formations have had in one way or another tried to preserve. New types of consumption, and that's the key word here, new types of consumption, planned obsolescence, an ever-rapid rhythm of fashion and styling changes, the penetration of advertising, television, and the media, generally to a hitherto unparalleled degree throughout society, the replacement of the old tension between city and country, center and province, by the suburb, and by universal standardization. Remember, Williams was talking about city and the country. That's a key kind of way of reading the modernist moment. Jameson says that's no longer possible anymore. The contrast is not between the city and the country, but between the city and the suburbs, or between the city and the multiple cities it contains within it. The city has expanded so much that it has swallowed the surrounding areas into its own body. Now we have fractured cities, edge cities, decentered cities, right? That is the historical moment because it's driven by an ever-expanding, what he's calling the ever-expanding media and advertisement section that has become, if you think, what is advertisement about? Advertisement is about selling the products that other people have made. But once advertisement has become its own reason, its own rationale for existence, it has expanded beyond that logic of production. The logic of advertisement now is advertisement. It exists to advertise other advertisements, right? That's what Jameson is trying to gesture towards. So it's become an all-consuming phenomenon. And that is the historical moment where you see the emergence of postmodernism, that particular style that's presentist, that's pastiche, that constantly recycles previous styles. But with Selvin, we are caught at this moment when the transition between two moments, two historical moments, and two cultural styles are competing against each other, and the novel incorporates that competition. So Selvin, for example, will talk about this new fracturedness. If people living in London who don't know what's happening in the room next to them, far more the street or how other people living. London is a place like that. It divide up in little worlds, and you stay in the world you belong to, and you don't know about what's happening in the other one except what you read in the paper. This seems to be a description of the postmodernist world that Jameson is describing. But remember, the novel is also interested in describing other forms of solidarity that cancel out that isolation. This is not the only sensibility of the novel. It is interested in finding, as we were saying in the first week, forms of belonging. Again, a modernist gesture, coexisting with this postmodernist, fractured, isolated beings. Right? So be careful not to treat the novel either as modernist or postmodernist, but try and see how it struggles between or trembles between those two moments. Because next week, finally, we're going to talk about the relationship between space and literature. So we've talked about production literature, consumption literature. Your final, next week, your final lecture will be on space and literature.